Case number 08-5138. Malady Drugs and Pharmaceuticals, LTD, et al., Appellant versus Karen P. Tandy, in her official capacity as Administrator, Drug Enforcement Administration. Mr. Fallon, for the appellant, Ms. Corcoran, for the appellee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. James Phelan on behalf of plaintiff appellants Malady Pharmaceuticals DPL and Novus Fine Chemicals. Your Honors, we've appealed the district court's order granting the DA's motion to dismiss because in ruling on the motion, the district court failed to construe all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. Specifically, we allege that on April 11, 2005, DEA agents demanded that non-party Malady Inc., a New Jersey company, surrender its DEA import registration. This registration was necessary for Malady Inc.
Didn't you, in your pleadings, or at least in an attachment adopted in your pleadings, say that you turned them over voluntarily?
There are administrative submissions that were attached to the complaint that describe the surrender as voluntary. However, I think what's important is
those are from your client, right? Those descriptions.
Yes, sir. Those are from our client, yeah. And in fairness, prepared by lawyers in my firm. Mm-hmm. But what's important about those letters is that they need to be placed in context. I think the rule in this court, as set forth in the Trudeau versus FTC case, is that yes, you can plead yourself out of court, but you can plead yourself out of court when you allege facts that make it impossible for you to win. And here we've not made it impossible for us to win. In the Trudeau case, Trudeau alleged that the FTC mischaracterized a consent order in a press release. Trudeau attached the press release.
Let me ask you, is duress necessary for your theory of the cause of action? I mean, you have this theory about constructive seizure. What does duress have to do with that? Isn't your theory that when the license is turned over to the DEA, that's a constructive seizure of the material that's on the site and that which is coming from India? Am I right? Is that's when the constructive seizure occurs?
The constructive, yes, Your Honor.
What does duress have to do with that?
Duress is part of the facts of this case, that the agent, the Malady Inc. manager who turned over the license.
Well, duress is inconsistent with voluntary.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In the context in which it occurred, the Malady Inc. manager felt that he was under pressure from the DEA.
Wait a second. Your law firm drafted the complaint and used the word duress, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your law firm drafted the administrative submissions and used the word voluntary, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And everything that I know is that about the law is that duress and voluntary can't be harmonized. They're different concepts. Duress suggests a lack of voluntariness.
Well, Your Honor, it certainly wasn't the Malady Inc.'s manager's idea to turn the license over, for instance, because Malady Inc. was getting out of the business and didn't need the import.
That's not duress. Duress suggests a lack of voluntariness. And so I think if you're going to hold on to duress as being part of your cause of action, I think you've got serious problems along the lines Judge Santel suggested. But I don't know. I don't know why you all insist on duress. You don't need it for this theory of constructive seizure, do you?
I would agree that we don't need duress for constructive seizure. That what matters is the license was handed over to the DEA agents. As a matter of fact, the Malady representative would testify that he turned the license over to DEA because DEA agents came in and said, you need to do this. This is in your best interest.
Well, what are we supposed to do in an instance where a plaintiff alleges an element of a cause of action that's not necessary for the legal theory, but they claim it's part of what actually happened, and then does something contradictory in the attachments? If Judge Santel's question and my question is right, if these are irreconcilable, hypothetically speaking, if you have an irreconcilable administrative filing attached to the complaint, what are we supposed to do with that case? If what is irreconcilable is not essential to the cause of action?
Well, I think the duress issue came up because the district court seized on it and the apparent controversy.
Why didn't you object? That is, if you agree with Judge Griffith that duress isn't required, that I take it all your point in here, this is all one big single plot by the government.
Yes, Your Honor.
It was going to somehow get the license, and when it got the license, that was the constructively all the future seizures, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And whether it was by duress or by trick or by cleverness or by the stupidity of your client, it was still all one plot.
Yes, Your Honor.
But you didn't make that point at all below. You when the district court said you didn't have duress, the only argument you raised with us is you didn't say to the district court, well, that's not an element. Duress isn't required.
The first time we saw this argument raised was in the district court's opinion.
That wasn't part of the motion to dismiss, was it?
The government never made that argument.
Their theory is all about aggregation.
Yes, right? Your Honor. So, quite frankly, we were surprised when we saw the reasoning for the district court's conclusion. The district court saying that we had had said that we'd voluntarily turned in.
Well, you did that. I mean, it's not unreasonable for the district court to look at this. You've got a complaint that says duress and an administrative filing that says not duress.
Well, respectfully, though, Your Honor, the administrative filing doesn't say not duress.
It says voluntary, which is not duress.
It says voluntary, and I think when placed in proper context, what the administrative filing was trying to communicate.
Why didn't you place that in context in your complaint? You're asking us to demand an awful lot of a district court judge, it seems to me, when they pick up a complaint and see a theory based on duress and then an administrative filing that says voluntary.
And it's incorporated into the complaint.
Yeah.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, the government didn't see this issue either, and I think the reason we didn't see it is because, and maybe because we're too close to the facts, and we know that the intent of the letter that went to the DEA was to remind the DEA that the license was not taken pursuant to a formal revocation. There hadn't been an adjudication that Malati Inc. was not entitled to maintain the license. But what we're trying to say in the letter to the DEA is that Malati Inc., in an effort to cooperate with the DEA, surrendered its license. This wasn't duress in the terms of a search warrant was executed, and among the things taken was the license. DEA came in and said to the Malati Inc. representative, you need to give me this license.
Why didn't you ask for a reconsideration of the court's decision if this was the first time that the idea of duress as an element was sort of sua sponte decided by the court?
Candidly, Your Honor, it's because we saw. Once we got the order, we researched the cases and saw what we thought the district court did in finding an allegation that was inconsistent, which she thought was inconsistent with the factual allegations in the complaint, and didn't think it was necessarily appropriate to raise what the district court might consider a new legal theory in a motion for reconsideration. But
well, it's going to be too late to raise that new legal theory later also then.
Well, which is why we chose the appeal, because what the fundamental error that the court made is failing to accept our factual allegation as to the circumstances surrounding the license surrender based solely on one word contained in administrative filings without giving us the opportunity to present testimony from the DEA agent, from the Malati Inc. representative, and if necessary, testimony from Mr. Pfeiffer.
Was there oral argument over the motion to dismiss?
No, Your Honor.
It was just on the...
And as I said, for the first time we were aware of this perceived inconsistency is when we saw what the district court did and how she extracted this one word out of the administrative submission and said, not only does it conflict with your factual allegation, it so conflicts with your factual allegation that you're out of court. But Judge Griffith, to get back to your original question, I don't think on these facts we necessarily have to show duress. We described it in the complaint because those are the facts. Those are the circumstances under which the license was surrendered. But what matters is, and our theory of the case below, is that DEA hatched a single plan that would allow it to seize all the inventory currently on the present premises of Malati Inc. and the inventory then in transit. That was our theory.
And what's the law on aggregation? Can you give me a short primer in a minute or less? I mean, I took a
quick... Take a couple of minutes. I wouldn't mind hearing this for a couple of minutes.
I took a quick
it's
look at
the... It's going to be short because there is no law, right? Are there any cases about this?
There's no law that we could find.
I thought it would be short. Yeah.
That, I mean, I think what matters is we looked at DEA internal guidelines that talked about the advisability of judicial forfeiture when items are taken pursuant to a single plan, maybe not necessarily on the same day, but when there's a single basis for seizing the items. But we couldn't find any cases that were directly on point.
Why didn't you raise this issue with the agency?
I'm sorry?
Why didn't you raise this issue with the agency? Why didn't you either raise it during your administrative proceeding, the petition, and or why didn't you file under 1608 a complaint, a claim for the money, and force them to go into court?
Your Honor, I'm not certain why a claim wasn't filed.
Well, so is there an exhaustion problem?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor, because the statute requires aggregation if the amount seized is in excess of $500,000.
Right. So if it does, and if you're right, why don't you have to bring that to the agency and tell them so that they can correct what they've done and bring it in court?
I believe because there are time limits within which to seek a judicial forfeiture, and our client had made a petition for remission, and by the time the petition for remission had been resolved, the time for bringing...
Right. So in other words, you want both. So you normally have a choice. You can either go the administrative route or you can go the court route. You chose to do the administrative route, which is discretionary, and now you want to also go the court route.
Well, I think what we want is for the DEA to follow the law.
Well, if to follow the law, though, you could have filed under 1608. You could have filed the claim, and that would have forced them to go to the U.S. attorney and file a case in court.
Yes, we could have, Your Honor, but I don't think that should absolve the DEA from their failure.
But that's what exhaustion is all about. That is, if you don't exhaust, then you lose the opportunity to raise the claim later.
I respectfully disagree that the statute does not say the DEA must aggregate unless the plaintiff, a claimant has failed to make a claim.
What does the statute say about aggregation?
It's nothing, Your Honor.
Right. So when you said a moment ago the statute required them to aggregate over $500,000, that was not an accurate statement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's forfeiture. The statute requires forfeiture.
The statute does not say anything about aggregation. So when you say that it doesn't say this about aggregation, doesn't say anything.
I'm sorry. You are right, Your Honor. But my point is that DEA had a plan to seize more than $1.4 million worth of merchandise destined for Mulati, Inc. DEA knew there was a single basis for seizing that. DEA knew that most of it was accomplished as a practical matter in a single action, the surrender of the license. DEA should have aggregated that amount and sought judicial forfeiture, quite frankly, because it's so large.
So we have an opinion from 2007 called Colon Calderon against DEA, and in it the petitioner argued that the DEA, this was a remittance petition, should have remitted or mitigated the forfeiture of his property because a notice of forfeiture did not satisfy the requirements of the Due Process Clause. We said, even assuming such a claim can be raised in this court, petitioner never raised the contention before the DEA, and therefore we will not consider it, citing our general law on the subject of non-jurisdictional exhaustion. Why doesn't this fit within that?
Because, Your Honor, it gets back to the statute requiring aggregation of amounts seized.
But there is also a statute, for example, in that case, requiring notice. In fact, we claim the issue there was not just that there was a statute requiring it, but that the Constitution required it. And yet the petitioner lost the opportunity to make that argument in court by not raising it below.
I don't think I have. I can answer that directly, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court. My name is Kelsey Brown Corker, and I'm here on behalf of the Drug Enforcement Administration. The plaintiffs have appealed on only one very narrow issue, which is whether the district court properly rejected their assertion of duress, because it was directly contradicted by exhibits which the plaintiff's CEO and president repeatedly affirmed under penalty of perjury that the action at issue, the surrender, was voluntary and done in order to demonstrate a good faith effort to show cooperation with the agency. The plaintiffs have attempted to circumvent this plain contradiction by ascribing a particular alternative meaning to the word voluntary.
Now, as counsel pointed out, you in your motion to dismiss, you didn't raise this argument at all. Why not, if it's so obvious?
We don't think that the outcome of their constructive seizure theory turns on their allegation of duress. So to us, it was not a particularly important issue. Our motion to dismiss below made the point that Judge Garland made about waiver. The district court decided not to address that issue and instead focused on just on the fact that the statute, as Judge Chantel, Chief Judge Chantel was pointing out earlier, does not say anything about aggregation.
Can I ask about the waiver, Judge Griffith? Could you flesh out what the waiver argument is?
Essentially, what you said earlier, which is that by failing to raise the issue before the agency, they did not have a right to now raise it before.
And would the method of raising it before the agency would have been to say that this is a claim for more than that filing a claim and on the theory that it's more than $500,000?
Yeah, filing a claim or in their actual petitions. They filed four separate petitions for mitigation in this case, none of which mentioned that they believed that the seizures should have been aggregated.
If they had said it just in that without actually filing the claim and you had denied it, we'd have this problem that remission petitions are discretionary, right?
Yes.
So would that have been enough to have raised it there to be able to raise it later?
I think that's a more complicated question. I know that our trial attorneys below decided to move on 12B6 grounds because the simpler issue here was that there was no statute anywhere that said anything about aggregation. And we didn't address hypotheticals where if they had done something differently. I can provide supplemental briefing on that if you're interested. I think it's quite clear it was waived here. However, in this appeal, they decided to only present this issue of whether their assertion of voluntary action is compatible with their assertion of duress.
You seem skeptical of the notion that there can be duress and yet voluntariness. Is that right?
Yes. I think that they have offered an alternative meaning now before this court that is untethered to any case law. Dictionary.
Can I read you some case law that seems directly on point? So this is the United States Supreme Court in Dixon versus the United States. And the court says, Professor Lefebvre has explained the duress of defense as follows. The rationale of the defense is not that the defendant has not engaged in a voluntary act. Rather, it is that even though he has done the act the crime requires and has the mental state which the crime requires, his conduct, which violates the literal language of the criminal law, is excused. And in the same case in dissent, although not in dissent on this point, Justice Breyer says, in respect to both duress and self-defense, for example, the defendant's illegal act is voluntary, indeed intentional, but the circumstances deprive the defendant of any meaningful ability or opportunity to act otherwise, depriving the defendant of a choice that is free. There is another court that has seen a distinction between duress and involuntariness.
I believe that's a criminal case from the way that you described it. And looking at the issue of duress, it seems to be spoken out differently in the criminal context.
Wouldn't that be more cutting? And the government has a higher burden in a criminal case than it does in the civil forfeiture.
Well, in the civil context, we have the Veach case, Veach v. England, which is a D.C. Circuit case, which lays out the test for duress, and it states that in order to establish duress, you must demonstrate first that the action at issue was involuntary, second, that the circumstances permitted no alternative, and third, that the government was responsible for creating the coercive circumstances. And so I think when you have a definition of duress that's applicable in this context that requires the plaintiff to show that the action was...
On the one hand, you may have a legal definition of what the word voluntary and involuntary means, and it appears to have a different meaning in a civil case and a criminal case, and I'm not sure where forfeiture fits between those two, mm-hmm. since sometimes it's criminal, sometimes civil. And you just have a complaint, which is using words in a sort of a more colloquial sense. Do we bind them by what they say, by one of several possible meanings of the word involuntary? At the 12B6 stage.
I think that even if this court were to find that the alternative definition that they've offered in this court has some sort of intuitive appeal, it would still be the case under Twombly that is the plaintiff's duty to assert facts that are raise their claims above the level of speculation. And so applying that standard here, when we have a complaint which states, which asserts duress, and exhibits where the plaintiff's CEO and president are affirming under penalty of perjury that the action at issue is voluntary, there's clearly at least a plain contradiction between the ordinary meaning of those two words.
The job of the district court on a 12b-6 is to try and find some rational way to reconcile them. Are you saying there's no rational way to reconcile?
Not that there's no rational, I do think that it's a little far-fetched to think that there's a way to reconcile them. But even putting that aside, the standard in Twombly is that you have to nudge your claims across the line from possible to plausible.
Yeah, Twombly was, is that really on point at all? I mean, Twombly's not argued in this. In your brief,
we cite it in our brief. Yes, I think it's actually our last sentence.
Yeah, I see you did.
I think that
was almost fanciful allegations in Twombly, wasn't it?
It was a naked assertion of conspiracy, which I don't think is that different than a naked assertion of duress. But we're not arguing that duress is analogous to conspiracy, and that Twombly is directly on point in that sense. Our point is that if the standard, the pleading standard that the Supreme Court set in that case, is moving your claims across the line from possible to plausible, you cannot satisfy that requirement by plainly asserting duress and then in your exhibit saying that the action was voluntary.
Well, you can if there's not an inherent difference, as Judge Garland suggests, at least one case suggests, not an inherent inconsistency between the two.
I think that even if there was this alternative definition that they're offering here, and again, perhaps in that criminal case lends support to it in that context, but here we have the Veach case, which states very clearly that in order to demonstrate duress, you have to show that the action was involuntary. There's a plain contradiction here, and when you have a plain contradiction, the burden is on the plaintiff in the pleadings to provide further factual enhancement to make their claims possible, and that didn't happen here. And any other standard would put quite an extraordinary burden on the district court to hypothesize about the various ways in which two seemingly irreconcilable statements might be compatible.
I'm not sure if that's the case. The district judge on 12b-6 is supposed to be taking it in the light most favorable to the pleader.
Right, but Trudeau is clear that when the exhibits...
You seem to be pushing the burden the other way.
No, I'm only pushing the burden the other way under Twombly, which I think mandates that, if, in fact, there's a naked assertion of duress, which is, I think, not quite as complicated as conspiracy, but it is a legal conclusion.
Well, what would be a non-naked or clothed definition of duress? I mean, it's pretty clear what they're saying in this case. They're saying, from the complaint, they're saying, on this date, they came in here. They got me to surrender my license. The duress word is like a characterization. It's a legal characterization, it's not missing a factual allegation.
I think that's an important point, because even if we didn't have these exhibits, if you look at the complaint in the paragraph in which the duress is asserted, it's juxtaposed with a statement. The only actual factual allegation there is that the DEA agent said it would be bad for the manager or for the company not to cooperate. And then it says that there was demand, pressure, and duress, and then goes on to say that the license was handed over in an effort to display good faith cooperation with the agency. So even within that paragraph, what's described doesn't sound at all like duress. And so when you combine that with these exhibits in which the company says repeatedly that the action was voluntary, it does not rise to the level that Twombly requires in the pleadings. There has to be more.
I missed your point there. Did you just say that as you read the complaint, it doesn't sound like duress? And the administrative filing doesn't sound, it says it's not duress. And so what's the signal? Putting those two readings together, what's your point?
My point is that the plaintiffs have not risen above the level of speculation. They have not made their claims plausible.
But duress isn't a necessary element of their theory. You agree to that, right?
I think it's not necessary in the opposite direction, in that they would not prevail even if they could demonstrate duress. But they have appealed on this one narrow issue when we were happy to accept their terms by responding just on that one narrow issue.
Really, it's the only issue that they could readily appeal on. I mean, that's what the district court turned her opinion on, wasn't it? Was the duress?
That particular inquiry, they could have, I think, appealed on the claim versus petition issue. They could have claimed that even if they were not able to show duress, that they should have appealed, won on their constructive seizure theory anyway. They did not. Thank you.
Can I briefly respond, Your Honor?
We'll restore 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
He walked out, right? Okay, you get 2 minutes back for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I believe it's the district court that made duress the issue, because the district court ruled that, and this is at page 120 of the joint appendix, inasmuch as Malati Inc. voluntarily surrendered its List 1 registration, DEA could not have constructively seized any shipments by demanding that Malati Inc. surrender its license, as plaintiffs now argue. So the court said, and this is her statement of the dispositive question, the question is whether the shipments should be aggregated when they were seized on different dates and in different places because there was no properly registered recipient in the United States. And we all agree that when Malati Inc. lost its license, there was no properly registered recipient in the United States. But the court has made that the key factor. She has elevated this issue of voluntary surrender of the license to be the key factor in the case.
And by not challenging it here, you've confirmed that is the only factor left, right? You can't go back now, you could have appealed on the ground that duress is not a required element. Court reversed what the district court did because the court wrongly said duress was an element. But you're not raising that point.
No, we're not here. We're not addressing the substantive issue of constructive seizure, the applicability of constructive seizure. What we're saying is, and we made that clear in our brief and the government didn't raise it, what we say is what the court should have done is looked at the facts in the light most favorable to us.
Are you not? Imagine we agreed with you. Are you not now stuck in the district court with the district court's holding that duress is an element?
I don't believe we're stuck with the district court certainly held that duress
by
was
not
an element.
Raising it on this appeal when you could have raised it. Are you not? You think we're going to have a series of interlocutory appeals on each individual issue?
Well,
why aren't you required to raise any issue that the court held against you when you appeal?
Because what the court held against us was an improper and premature factual finding.
But they also, in your view, held against you an improper and wrong legal finding, right?
But I think the improper and wrong legal finding relates only to pleading, that what the court shouldn't have done.
No, it's not only pleading. The district court essentially ruled that as a matter of law, in order to satisfy your constructive seizure argument, you have to prove duress.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think what she says, and this is at page 120 of the joint appendix, is that it's the because the surrender was voluntary, there could have been no constructive seizure.
Right. So if it's voluntary, forget about the word duress. If it's voluntary, you can't have you lose.
I think.
And you agree with that?
If it's voluntary, yes. If we had decided we didn't want to be in that business and gave DEA the license, we might lose. And part of it also turns, I think, on the fact that we've alleged that DEA demanded the license because it knew the shipments were coming in. DEA wanted to be in a position to prevent Malati Inc. from taking possession of these shipments.
If you had the opportunity to prove the facts, what would you say you meant by the words duress here? What's the evidence?
I believe the evidence will be testimony from the Malati Inc. manager, which we paraphrase in the complaint, that DEA agents appeared in his office and demanded the license from him.
You didn't say demanded. It says what you said in the complaint, as opposing counsel just pointed out, is that that they came and they said it would be bad for the company to challenge this demand, and DEA officials stated that it would be helpful to surrender. That's not quite the same thing, is it?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, at paragraph 18, we allege that on April 11, 2005, DEA officials again returned to Malati Inc.'s Edison facility and demanded surrender of the company's
right,
DEA.
Right, but does not the next paragraph explain what you mean by that?
That's what
told you it would be bad for the company to challenge and that it would be helpful to surrender.
Yes.
And you regard that, is that involuntary?
I think in the context, yes, I think it was involuntary. These are DEA agents. This is a regulated business. I don't know if the facts will show that these agents are armed. I don't know what it will show about the sophistication of the manager, but you certainly have agents of the key regulatory authority appearing in your office demanding that you turn over the license because it will be helpful to you, and clearly placing pressure, at least I believe the evidence will show that this is clearly placing pressure on the manager to take an action which he wouldn't have done on his own. Again, I think this is to be contrasted with Malati Inc. deciding, we don't want to be in this business anymore. We don't want the import registration. We're going to give it to the DEA. Please take this from us. We're out of business. We don't want these chemicals anymore. That's not this case. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Seeing no further questions, the time is expired, and we'll take a short recess before the next argument.